But this is a president whose former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, former national security advisor, Mike Flynn, former campaign advisor, Roger Stone, former deputy campaign chair, Rick Gates, former associate, George Papadopoulos, all of them have been convicted of federal crimes. In addition, last year, Trump University settled a $25 million fraud lawsuit. Last month, President Trump admitted misusing his own charitable foundation's money, was ordered to pay $2 million. You really think President Trump is concerned about rooting out corruption?
I think most of what you listed and most of the people that were indicted or convicted were alleged to have been part of some sort of huge Russian conspiracy. But I think what we found out from the Inspector General's report is that it was all based on a false premise.
That was Senator Rand Paul fielding questions about impeachment and related issues on Sunday from CNN's Jake Tapper. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. I'm Matt Welch, joined by my comrades Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Hello, House managers.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Impeachment Week Monday.
Before we get started, I just want to say thank you to everyone listening out there on behalf of all four of us for your historic levels of donation to our webathon, which wrapped last week. It was awesome. A lot of you cited our podcasting work as part of your donations. And thank you. It makes us feel even more warmer and tinglier than the eggnog that I started this morning with. Okay, so big week for impeachment, as Suderman rightly noted. The full House, not the Fuller House, the full House is expected to make its final vote on their two articles of impeachment, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, this Wednesday or Thursday, depending. The House Judiciary Committee early this morning, this Monday morning, released its 658-page report detailing the Democratic Party's case, including what it says are, quote, multiple federal crimes, unquote, committed by the president. Here is a money summary. President Trump has realized the framers' worst nightmare. They have that voice in there. He has abused his power in soliciting and pressuring a vulnerable foreign nation to corrupt the next United States presidential election by sabotaging a political opponent and endorsing a debunked conspiracy theory promoted by our adversary, Russia. Of a particular intrigue, this is, we've finished the quote now, given the sound that we played at the beginning, the Washington Post reported yesterday that 30 Democrats are lobbying House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, dentures or no dentures, to appoint as one of just three House managers of the Senate trial, none other than the Libertarian Independent and former Republican and buddy of Rand Paul, Justin Amash, to do that work. So there's lots to chew on here, but Suderman, since you squawked first, you get the first cue. There was a piece from the longer impeachment report of this morning that continued sort of a thought that's been bugging me here. I will quote from it. They say that Trump has, quote, fallen into a pattern of behavior. This is not the first time he has solicited foreign interference in an election, been exposed, and attempted to obstruct the resulting investigation. He will almost certainly continue on this course. They go on to conclude that, quote, for all the reasons given above, President Trump will continue to threaten the nation's security, democracy, and constitutional system if he is allowed to remain in office. That threat is not hypothetical, unquote. Peter, is it me? Does it sound a little like preemptive impeachment here? Little, doesn't this set off your Philip K. Dick dar?
I am.
Yeah, Peter.
I'm curious
this morning
to find that I have one of those. Although, I mean, wouldn't that just be Valis, the pink laser that shoots from the satellite into Philip K. Dick's head and lets him know that the Empire of Rome never really ended? This is a real thing. He went kind of crazy.
This tone feels. This tone feels
kind of crazy
to me for starting this podcast.
So yeah, so that right. So I think we're all in Valis mode. We all have a pink laser shooting insanity into our heads right now. If you are following impeachment, or maybe even also if you're not, I don't know. And I guess what I would say is that I'm going to both sides this because both sides have already made up their minds. And if your argument is, you know, that Democrats have kind of pre-impeached, well, of course they have. Democrats were looking to impeach President Trump before all the Ukraine stuff started. They wanted there was at least a faction there that wanted to go through with this within the Democratic Party pretty much from day one. And that continued, and that faction grew, and there was anxiety, you know, sort of within the party more broadly, and certainly at the leadership level. And then they did the, you know, they went through with the Mueller report and the Mueller investigation, and that came out. And Nancy Pelosi kind of looked around. Nancy Pelosi, who had always been somewhat skeptical of impeachment, just on political grounds, kind of looked around and said, "Well, I don't think we have it." And then the Ukraine stuff came out, and what changed then was that if you go back to this summer and you listen to Republicans who had all said, well, the Mueller report was a dud, you know, it didn't really expose anything. They called it a hoax. I think that's too far. There was some valuable information in there, in particular about how Trump kept trying to subvert the Constitution and failing because his subordinates wouldn't carry through with stuff. But what changed was that this summer Republicans said, wait, if there's a quid pro quo, if Trump actually did what he is reported to have done, what he's alleged to have done, then that would be pretty bad. Then that might even be something that he could be impeached for. And then what Democrats did was proceed with impeachment proceedings that more or less proved that Trump did exactly what everybody was saying on Ukraine, and Republicans then flipped. And so now you have, on the one hand, Democrats saying, well, we're certain we want to impeach him. And on the other hand, Lindsey Graham saying, I'm not trying to be a fair juror. I made no secret. I'm not going to be impartial. I just want this thing to be over with. I don't want to hear any witnesses. I don't want any more information. And so in an environment like that, no one is looking to treat this as like an investigative process where you learn information and then make up your mind. Everyone's mind is made up, and they are looking for a process that will serve the end that they already desire.
Catherine, pursuant to some of that, you heard Rand Paul in the broader interview, which I encourage people to go and watch or listen to. He made what he framed as a constitutional argument against doing impeachments all the time. You also read our colleague Jacob Sullum's great piece, I think, about how House Democrats, by speeding through this process, have kind of relinquished the sobriety, the investigative sobriety that you would want them to use in this, sort of failing to show the necessary seriousness. And then meanwhile, you got Amash out there making Peter's last point, which is that, you know, Lindsey Graham is kind of usurping his own constitutional oaths to prejudge the case in favor of Trump. So question to you is, how conflicted is your libertarian heart?
It's always conflicted when the main topic is partisan politics, which is what the main topic is mostly here. Like, people are using words about the Constitution, but they are saying things about partisan politics. And I think that is one reason that I've always been skeptical in general of people whose founding political ideas are kind of anchored in constitutional originalism or some strong view about what the Constitution says about the role of the state and of politicians, because the Constitution is awfully malleable. And so you're hearing all these people say, the Constitution says I need to do it my way. And, you know, there are limits to this theory. There really are. And, you know, sometimes the Constitution is really freaking clear about what is and isn't allowed. But Jacob's column, which you referenced, Matt, very astutely points out that this is probably actually going to come down to whether Democrats did enough kind of legal style diligence. And that's why I think it's interesting that you started with this quote about basically, like, do we need to stop him before he like extorts again? Because that is how a normal person would think about this. Right. Like, well, do we need to impeach him? There's an election coming up after all. And the only reason you would choose impeachment rather than waiting for the election is if you think he's going to do something bad between now and the election. That's how a person who is not thinking about it in legalistic terms or in constitutional terms or in terms of kind of the benefit of their party would frame this question. And so, you know, the fact that strikes you as a little like dystopian prejudgy, Matt, I find odd because it kind of strikes me as the only commonsensical thing in this whole conversation.
Right. But you don't at a trial, and it will be a trial, even if it's not a criminal accusation here, despite the fact that they said in the report today that he committed crimes. But that's not what the articles of impeachment said. In a trial, you like want to try to prove stuff about the conduct, about the what he did, not what he might do going forward. I think that's.
Yeah. But like the other 630 pages were mostly about what he did. Right.
Yeah. Nick, one of the things that Amash has said throughout this process is that Republicans are making a concerted effort to mislead. isn't that basically kind of on the nose? And then so if it is, doesn't flushing out this behavior, doesn't like making Jim Jordan, you know, take off his shirt and pound the table and just yell at everybody, isn't that like a worthwhile side effort, even if you oppose the process?
I just want to note really quickly that shirt removal would be an escalation. So far, he's just taking off his jacket.
Yeah, it was jacket.
I would like it to stop there, if at all possible.
I'm really glad that my grandparents left the slum holes of Europe in order to come here to talk about Jim Jordan. You know, in the 21st century, this is all to the good, Matt. What's going to happen? Impeachment has been revealed as a nakedly political activity. The Democrats have their impeachment inquiry. They'll vote on that, and it'll go to the Senate, where it will be a ridiculously partisan event. And they may show that Trump actually did, try to bribe or extort or whatever you want to call it with the Ukrainian government, which had been involved in kind of futzing around in an anti-Trump way in the election, not in the way that Trump is talking about, but nobody really denies that various elements of the Ukrainian government were trying to influence the election in 2016, just as Russia was, just as the U.S. has done with every election that we could get our hands into. They'll be able, maybe they can prove that in a nice way. They can prove that Trump was obstructing justice by basically relying on certain types of executive privilege or claims of executive privilege. That'll be adjudicated, and then people will decide whether or not it's worth removing the president if any of that is proven or not. And we know that it's not going to work in terms of the removal. It might weaken him in the general election, or it might strengthen him. But this, what has been revealed is that with very few instances, impeachment is always nakedly political. And people are getting kind of sick of politics, I think, politics usurping
everything.
But
isn't that part of the founders' conception of impeachment? I mean, when they were writing about it, they weren't this is a legal trial.
No. Yeah.
They were like, partisan passions may be inflamed and may come into this. And
yes,
partisanship was designed to be part of the check on executive power through the impeachment process.
Right. So does it mean that impeachment, like let's say Trump is being impeached and then he's not removed from office? Will we see that as a failure of the process or not? That also depends on your partisan politics. I mean, I think what is going to become real, and especially, you know, last week there was a lot of budget movement. And lo and behold, you know, during all of this, and I think this from a specifically libertarian point of view is much more important. The government decided, you know, is already spending record amounts of money, and they're going to spend even more in the coming year. And that's actually one of the things that we should probably be more focused on. And it doesn't dismiss any of this. We can all agree that Trump is an awful human being and a bad president in terms of following processes and stuff like that. In the end, that's not going to be any more important to his legacy than Bill Clinton being impeached and not removed from office. It will rest on these larger issues of, you know, is the U.S. in a better place, you know, at the end of however long he's in office?
I always find when people ask this question, like, well, will it be a failure of the process or will the process have worked, that I discover in my heart anew every time an extremely low standard for what success of the process is, which is like, did it end in a violent coup? No. We're good, which, you know, maybe this is like the soft bigotry of low expectations. But if he is impeached and removed or impeached and not removed, and then we have a peaceable election and everyone abides by the results of that election, that seems like a success of the process to me. Am I broken? Has politics broken me?
Yeah, I think you are, in the same way that people are increasingly saying, like, oh, you know, the real problem is Trump is not going to leave office in 2024. He is going to take over the government.
I believe Trump will leave office in 2020 or 2024.
Yeah.
I am fully confident that will occur, which then to me is like, okay, this is, you know, but am I, this is fine dog, right? Like, am I just sitting here aflame drinking my coffee? This is fine.
I think that there's the lane that I'm maneuvering myself into in thinking about this is that here's a good process. The House forwards this along. We have the trial in the Senate. You know, John Bolton testifies, so we get more information about things. Everybody reveals themselves to be even worse than we think that they are now. Trump is acquitted, and everyone just gets less in the next election. This is the process works fine, according to my. This is fine.
I think we are totally on track for that. You know, and again, recognize that it's not a coincidence that this is an election year. There is no clear Democratic candidate, you know, who's a consensus. The Democrats have talked about, you know, in general, all they want is somebody who can beat Trump. They have not been able to produce that candidate yet. And it's starting to go sideways on them. It's starting to go sideways on impeachment, you know, and that, you know, a lot will change as these proceedings get underway. But the Democratic Party right now, and I say this as somebody who loathes the Republican Party equally as the Democratic Party, they are shitting their pants because this should be just as the Republicans should have beaten Obama when he was running for reelection. You know, the Democrats are realizing now they have a historically unpopular president who is almost certainly going to win re-election. And they are crap in the bed, and they're going to pull out all stops. And Matt, I do think it's going to reveal, as bad as Trump and his Republican lapdogs are, you're starting to see a frenzy among Democrats because they realize, my God, we're going to lose this. And then the question is, when everybody reveals just how horrible and ugly they are, how does the country react? Do we keep going down a hyperpolarization route that is kind of destructive of everything, or do we restart stuff? Where, you know, what I don't know what the reset button is, but it's clear that we need one, and sooner rather than later. And I don't think impeachment is going to be it.
Peter, at least I mean, maybe impeachment will happen, because I just read in Mother Jones that dozens of newspapers have editorialized in favor of impeachment, including the Washington Post, the New York Times, LA Times, USA Today. So that
I love this hate beat by you, Matt. Like, tell us again, Uncle Matt, about how newspaper editorial endorsements don't mean a goddamn thing.
No, I'll skip over that because it's too predictable. But Nick brought up Democrats. Let's use that as and also just sort of like the strange impotence in the face of an unpopular candidate. Let's use that as a way of talking about the kind of earthquake that happened last week in England, when the Conservative Party behind Boris Johnson won a huge landslide victory over Jeremy Corbyn and Labour. I'll get to Nick's special insight, because he interviewed Daniel Hannan, a leading Brexiteer last week. We'll get to that in a second. But Peter, take the kind of American domestic Democratic Party politics angle at looking at that. Joe Biden, like within a half a second, says, look what happens when the Labour Party moves so far to the left. It comes up with ideas that are not able to be contained within a rational basis quickly. And also Boris Johnson is, quote, kind of a physical and emotional clone of the president. How do you assess the kind of the way that the Democratic Party presidential race is internalizing or dealing with or rationalizing the debacle of Jeremy Corbyn?
I think it started before Jeremy Corbyn and before these elections in particular, when it looked like it started to look like Elizabeth Warren was slipping. And she has, for the past 6 to 8 weeks, been really slipping in the polls from a position of being the co-frontrunner. And that started when she at first couldn't answer and then tried to answer questions about Medicare for All. So Medicare for All is, look, it's a healthcare issue, and healthcare is the biggest single issue. It was the biggest issue in the 2018 midterms. Democrats ran on it successfully by saying, look, we want to basically keep the protections that are in Obamacare. And Republicans said a bunch of other stuff. And Democrats did quite well with that. But by pushing to Medicare for All, they've done more than just say, well, we want to expand government's role in healthcare. They have said that they want to expand government's role in the biggest sector of the economy, the biggest and a huge dancey thing in your life, Catherine, dancing Maggie Ward, right? Like, so Catherine is doing like a little Peter on a healthcare monologue dance in here. It's good. It's totally fair. I deserve that dance. That way, it is a symbol and a signal to the voters that Democrats have gone very far left. And Jeremy Corbyn was similarly a symbol and a signal to voters in Britain that the Labour Party had gone very far left. And in many ways, this is a vote for Boris Johnson to continue with Brexit. But at least as much, I think, it is a vote against Jeremy Corbyn and Corbynism and the kind of the knee-jerk socialist leftism that had overtaken the Labour Party. And Democrats in the United States, looking at the state of their own primary, are very obviously getting anxious about that, which is why you now see Elizabeth Warren, of all people, running around on the campaign trail talking about choice and how her transition plan, which is this other part of her Medicare for All plan about how she's, it's basically an admission that she's not going to do it, but how her transition plan will emphasize choice and let people have a choice of different plans. And that is, I think, a pretty direct reaction to this sense that the Democratic Party in the United States had moved too far left. And then further, that we are seeing that left parties in the Western world have moved too far to the left, and that voters, in particular working class voters who are often the swing voters in Western democracies, are reacting to that by putting populist conservatives in power.
Nick, you're our instant UK expert by virtue of interviewing Daniel Hannan 10 days ago or whatever. And it's a great interview. Go listen to it at the recent interview with Nick Gillespie. What's your takeaway seeing the results of Boris Johnson et al?
I don't think it has any clear application to the United States. I think that the issues in England were significantly different, and plus the difference in electoral systems. It's not clear to me that going to the left is the death of the Democratic Party as much as the actual candidates that are there. Because, you know, and Joe Biden has been holding steady as the kind of centrist. And I forget who it was, Ed Reason, who pointed out that compared to even Hillary Clinton from the last time, Joe Biden is calling for like massive spending and tax increases in a way that would not have been moderate for a Democrat in the 2016 election. So I think it's worth, you know, thinking about these things in tandem, but it's far from clear that anything that happened in England is really indicative
of
anything.
I would
that's
just note that Biden
here.
Is very consistently in head-to-head polls beating Trump. And so these are obviously not, you know, necessarily predictive, but it's a very consistent large spread, typically about 8 or 9 points when you match Biden versus Trump. Biden tends to win in national polls.
Catherine, Andrew Sullivan, kind of contra Nick's assertion of a limited application, says in his New York Magazine reaction to this, there's a historical pattern in which Britain echoes the U.S. in political shifts. Thatcher, Reagan, George H.W. Bush and John Major, Blair and Clinton. He even includes Obama and Cameron. I'm not sure how much I believe that. Brexit and Trump. And his conclusion, which I want you to ponder out loud about, is that the political sweet spot in the next few years, and he means kind of everywhere, will be a combination of left economics and a celebration of the nation state. What think you?
You're making me cry. Why would you make me cry? That's the worst.
Well, the good news is Andrew Sullivan can't name the 50 state capitals
of the United
States. I can't name
the 50 state capitals of the United States.
So despite his living here for many years, I would posit that he's not the tightest
observer of this kind of like, oh, here's the parallels between the two nations about which I am an expert is the sort of thing that Andrew Sullivan can write and sound credible, at least to parochial Americans like myself. But I think he is probably loosely correct about those two ingredients forming the roux of our political gumbo going forward. Yep.
I did that. Keep going.
Is this a
baby?
Is there shrimp?
Come on, finish the
gumbo?
Metaphor.
Is this a sausage gumbo?
You can decide.
Yeah. Come on. Gumbo is a Creole dish.
Yeah,
what are you talking about? Come on.
And that is extremely disheartening, right? Like, this is extremely bad news. I think people who are looking at the UK elections and seeing the defeat of socialism are misreading the signs. I also think people who are looking at Brexit and seeing exactly the same thing as Donald Trump are misinterpreting that phenomenon as well. But I think directionally, lefty economics and nation-oriented chauvinism slash populism are absolutely, and I think undeniably, on the rise. And when you bring them together, it's bad news for us libertarians.
Suderman, so we're going to have a Democratic presidential debate, the 11th, I think, that we've had so far in this cycle. That's happening on Thursday at the beautiful campus of Loyola Marymount University in Southern California, very close to the Reason office, headquarters by there. But this time we're only going to have 7 candidates. No Michael Bloomberg, no El Bloombito, no Cory Booker, no Tulsi, no Julian Castro, but Tom Steyer will be there. You'll all be heartened to know. Suderman, there was a piece in the New York Times just this morning that you didn't read, so I want you to comment on it at great length. That the headline is, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have a problem, each other, which is basically to say that there's only so much of a progressive electorate out there. And as long as they're both still competing, Biden will knock the socks off the divided progressive field. Do you think, having watched and bringing it all back to Medicare at all times, Peter, that there's something to that? There's like just a limit, even within the Democratic Party, for going full or even half totally progressive.
Yes. I think that the thesis in that headline is actually quite correct. And I actually think that this is the reason that when Elizabeth Warren announced her health care position, she didn't put out a plan. For months, she had no plan. What she did was, at a debate, she said, on health care, I'm with Bernie. And there's a very specific reason that she chose not to produce her own plan initially, but to endorse the Bernie Sanders plan, which is that she believed that in order to win the nomination, and I think correctly, she believed that she had to get the bulk of the Bernie voters. And whether that meant Bernie Sanders eventually dropping out or whether that just meant luring voters away from Bernie Sanders, she thought she had to get them. And she understood that Bernie Sanders' signature issue, he's got all of these big spending plans. I mean, it's just trillions and trillions of dollars worth of stuff. But the thing that he emphasizes the most and the thing that his supporters emphasize the most is Medicare for all, single payer healthcare. And so she jumped on the Bernie train on healthcare for a reason, because she thought she could just get it out of the way and make Bernie Sanders answer all the tough questions, because, you know, it was his plan and not hers. And she would then get to talk about a wealth tax and how she was going to spend all of that money on education reforms. And so I think that was Warren's analysis from the beginning. I think it's correct. And I think if you look at the polls now, where when she has started to slip, Bernie Sanders has actually started to improve a little bit. But there is a real ceiling for progressive politics, even within the Democratic base. And for one of those candidates to win, the other one will have to Highlander-like lose.
Nick, on the other hand, is kind of what you talked about here and wrote about last week, and I'd like to expand on it a little bit. Last week, we had not only a $738 billion approval of the National Defense Authorization Act. Mm. And I just, as a aside here, I'm old enough to remember, seriously, 4 years ago, when Rand Paul got a world of grief for suggesting that the defense budget be hiked all the way up to $696 billion. So like 40 plus billion dollars ago. And when he did that, he did it with a bunch of offsets as well to kind of make a point. But he got a lot of grief for it. And like this thing happened last week. It was like a 30 seconds of a headline. And then everyone quickly forgot and moved on to the...
Oh, and yeah, and didn't even really discuss fully the revelations about the Afghanistan
Yes, exactly.
War. Where we were treated to thousands of documents showing that the Pentagon, the Defense Department, has been lying consistently and systematically about what's going on and what they actually think about prosecuting what is, you know, now America's longest war and one of its least successful.
And what you wrote about is it's still, I think, preliminary, right? A budget deal that's broader and in the trillions. And again, just not any discussion about this. It's not making much in the way of political headlines. Well, the thing that is the House agreeing on trade agreements with the president. I'll give you a choose your own adventure here, Nick. One will be, is it possible that the kind of smoke about impeachment is obscuring, actually, the extent to which Democratic policies are policy preferences are similar to those of Donald Trump, or at least, you know, they haven't sorted it out yet. Their views on trade, their views on spending and these kinds of things. That's door number one. Or number two, is it just the center of the Democratic debate has moved so far to the left, pursuant to what you were talking about before with Joe Biden, that we've lost the ability to recognize that.
I think I'll go with door number one. Matt, show me what I've won. Is it the lady or the tiger?
It's, why not both?
Or the lady tiger? I don't know, but it's. I think that we have entered a scary new realm where budget realities no longer matter. Nobody seems to be caring about any of this kind of stuff, about how much are we spending, how much are we borrowing. And that's going to end in tears. We, you know, I think libertarians in general and some people on the left and some people on the right have been Cassandras about this for, you know, for well over a decade. I mean, really going back at least to the early Bush years, that you can't keep borrowing, you know, $1 out of $4 you spend or more at various points and expect things to end well. But what has changed is only that the voices that care about that seem to have really receded. And I do think, you know, this is an old libertarian talking point, but it's one that's worth maintaining or keeping on, is that, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats, or liberals and conservatives, will argue a lot. They'll, you know, they'll impeach one another. They'll really go hammer and tongs after each other. But if you look at what's actually happening, you see a weird unanimity between these two forces, which is that there should be more government spending. There should be more borrowing. There should be more, ultimately, government intervention into the economy through this kind of spending. And that just continues to proceed apace. And we need to be calling it out, and we need to try and, you know, make arguments that bring it back to the center of, you know, of political discussion, because there is simply no good way out of this. I mean, either it's going to spark inflation, it's going to lead to a major rescission, a disruptive rescission in government services, which ultimately would be good, but would be very disruptive. Or it's going to lead to massive tax increases, you know, it's going to, or some combination of those. And that is really the story that's going on as we enter the 2020s, is that people have just said, like, I don't give a shit. Let's just keep spending. Let's, you know, let's find another credit card that we haven't maxed out yet and full steam ahead.
Matt, on your point about Joe Biden and the relative leftward shift of the Democratic Party, I do think it's worth just pointing out that Joe Biden, who is the occupying the moderate role in this race, is calling for $3.4 trillion in tax hikes, which is double, more than double the amount of tax hikes that not exactly a moderate Hillary Clinton was calling for just 3 years ago in 2016, and that Pete Buttigieg, the other supposed moderate, is calling for $7 trillion in tax hikes. So double the other moderate. And then everybody else is sort of, or all, I should say, at least all of the other major contenders are just much further, have much bigger tax hike packages than that. And so it does kind of tell you what the shift has been even in the last couple of years.
Catherine, you are sensitively attuned to any possible positive thing about Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Didn't he say something within the last week in relationship either to what was happening in Britain or America, domestic stuff, that, hey, we were the party of lowering deficits and we need to be doing that again?
Yeah, he.
Or am I making
that up?
I mean,
he probably said something like that. It sounds like something he'd say, because I am sensitively attuned to him not completely sucking as much as everyone else. Yes, Mayor Pete Buttigieg says Democrats should be deficit hawks. Like, we should all be deficit hawks. Deficit hawkery is a good look on everyone. But it's interesting to me that Pete Buttigieg, despite taking a pretty significant amount of criticism for saying stuff like that, and also watching Cory Booker get walloped for saying, hey, actually, maybe economic growth and opportunity are good and important, especially to minority communities, in the last debate, that he just keeps kind of saying it and he just keeps kind of doing it. And I think it might be, just floating this, because he actually believes it's true. I think that, like, there are still a lot of Democrats, including this one who's running for office, who know the thing that Nick just said, who understand that this is a bill that comes due, and who don't want the only choice to be $7 quadrillion in everything every day in all the directions forever. But it's very clearly an electoral loser for him, I think. And that's disappointing.
And for moderate Democrats, being a deficit hawk often means raising a lot of taxes, because that's one way to close the gap between spending and taxes. That's what the deficit is the difference between how much money the government raises and how much money it spends.
And Buttigieg's rhetoric around tax raising has been similarly reasonable. He has basically said he has not done the thing that many Democrats have done, which is to pretend they can get all of this somehow with the tippy top?
Two cents.
So her 2 cent tax tippy that is top. Actually tippy a top. 2 cent tax plus a 1 cent tax surtax on rich people. This is Elizabeth Warren. 2 cents, two pennies from billionaires. But now it's actually with Medicare for All. It's also 6 cents. It's nonsense.
Hey, you know, at least the Democrats are talking about raising taxes to pay for their stupid programs, whereas, you know, this is where the conversation among the American people is that, like, we've been trained over the past 20 years or more not to even link taxation and spending anymore. So, you know, ultimately what is troubling is that Donald Trump wants to spend more money. If he doesn't care about paying for it now or, you know, in the future, Democrats want to spend more money. They'll say they want to raise taxes. We know they're not going to raise taxes, or they're not going to be able to. And what's frustrating to me is that people are willing to just listen to the promises of new glitzy programs and kind of follow in that direction. And what's particularly disturbing to me is that Republicans, who at least rhetorically had been the party of fiscal restraint, don't even pretend anymore. And so, again, this is not really a partisan thing. This is like the moment we're in, and we need to figure out ways to kind of, you know, stop people from thinking that, you know, Donald Trump is going to reduce spending. He hasn't. He's blowing out the deficit and the debt like nobody's business. And in this, he is following exactly like in Obama's and George Bush's footsteps.
I would caveat, though, that President Obama had very high deficits in his first term, and they did come down. They were on a downward trajectory in the last four, maybe 5 years he was president. I don't have the numbers in front of me.
The increase is that he put through, and this was, you know, it was in the first year, in the first fiscal year he was in office. It was partly because of Bush's spending expansion, but it was also Obama's. And that it's, you know, you see in spending levels a true ratchet effect where, you know, things went up a lot and then they kind of leveled off, but they didn't come down. And there is something insane in the rhetoric in American politics now where it's like any kind of spending cut on any program is considered a calamity that cannot be withstood. I mean, you see this in people, you know, angry. We're at a full employment rate, et cetera. The economy has been expanding for, you know, a decade. And the idea that anybody would lose food stamp benefits is just considered, you know, we can't deal with that. This is, you know, the whole ratchet effect stuff that people like Robert Higgs and others have identified, where government spending, government power goes up, and then it never comes down to where it was. It goes up in a crisis and then never comes down. So while it's true that Obama, you know, deficits decreased from his first years towards his last, they were still massive deficits.
And the, you know, remember the classic Keynesian take about stimulus spending in order to revive a moribund economy was you inject it in and then you take it back out, in theory. So we went from what, $2.8 trillion federal budget to $3.7 trillion, give or take on both ends, in the Bush to Obama handoff as part of, hey, we need stimulus and all of this. And then it didn't recede, and it only got momentarily flattened after absolutely bruising budget negotiations with House Republicans that dominated American politics there for a couple of years and have now since been forgotten as we have continued to jack things up. And let's not forget that when things go bad, like with the economy, which does happen on occasion, There's an increase in demand for government services. So let's all imagine a future in which suddenly people want more of a safety net and demand for services, and there's less economic activity built on a baseline of $1 trillion deficits as we stand
the
right now.
Congressional Budget Office always makes this point, is that in a crisis, if you have high debt loads, it makes you much less able to respond.
Also, I just want to tell you guys, like, mm-hmm. we heard the solution from Rand Paul, which is we're going to cut that aid to Ukraine, and then it's all just going to... It's going to balance out. It's going to be fine.
That's not nice, Catherine.
It's, you know, this is the president's prerogative to...
It's $400 million.
...safeguard not only our national security, but our fiscal...
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, obviously Rand Paul is working a political game, but it is kind of, this is like if any of you have ever had ruinous credit card debt and you're like, well, you know what, this one purchase isn't the difference between me being broke and me being solvent, so I'll just spend it. It's like we need to be cutting
there's a special stupid, though, I think you can agree, Nick, that hovers around the notion of cutting foreign aid, right? I mean, this is, we've written about this in Reason many, many times.
It's a small amount overall, but it's also relatively, it's relatively easy to cut.
And that people are sort of willing to cut. And so we should cut it, right? Like, I actually, this is, the Rand Paul interview with Jake Tapper that we started with at the top of the show. He sort of makes this point during the interview that, you know, it's maybe not the proper role of the United States to just be doling out cash to all manner of nations all the time. You know, it's like the Onion story of, like, worst person you know makes excellent point. Like, it's the worst thing that could have happened. And it mostly it's actually not worst person you know. It's like, I remember when, like, most of the stuff Rand Paul said out loud was stuff like that. It was like, let's not drone people. Let's not spend money we don't have, especially not if it screws up our foreign policy. Like,
the libertarian moment was only a moment.
I'm old enough to remember when Rand Paul said stuff I didn't this hate is... sometimes, and I wish he would go back to that. And he probably will, to be honest. I mean, that is one thing. It's like, if he survives the Trump years, maybe none of us will, but if he does, he'll probably go back to just kind of being like a good, useful deficit hawk who likes privacy again. And that will be an interesting thing, not just with him, but with everyone who's been kind of polarized by this impeachment stuff, to see how willing people are to go back to that normal.
One of the disturbing trends, which I don't think gets discussed enough over, that's been taking place over the past 15 years or so, is that the budget, the federal budget, increasingly, you know, by two-thirds of it now, straining towards three-quarters, is mandatory spending, or so-called mandatory spending, on entitlements and other programs that don't have to be renewed every year. They just keep it growing. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, stuff like that. You know, in the early 2000s, the budget was split more between discretionary spending that had to get renewed every year and mandatory spending. The more that it tips towards mandatory, the harder it is for politicians to actually confront what needs to be cut or what needs to be restrained in order to find any kind of balance. And that is why,
Peter Suderman, I have dreams about you sitting at my father's table, in which I offer my plan for liquidating Social Security.
Are you sure that was a dream, Matt?
That's a good question. That's a good question.
Here's the Vallis. Are you sure you weren't visited by a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses or something, Matt, before you were
struck by the
pink
laser? This is what we need, is a Vallis pink laser for deficit hawkery that just zoom like lasers into everybody's brain and makes them think that actually the deficit still matters.
I'm going to go ahead and take the controversial anti-mind control stance here on this libertarian podcast.
It's not mind control. It's true belief.
Party pooper. It's wisdom.
Let's go to our transfer to our end of show. What have you been consuming? What psychedelic drugs have you been consuming, Peter Suderman? I'm going to go first because I'm just going to brag out loud for how awesome my Friday was. I went to a tiny or smallish, beautiful wooden, I think, Norwegian church in Brooklyn, the Holy Apostles Episcopal Church, in order to see a small, in front of 75 people, including lots of kids, concert and like talk about stuff, a performance by Kristen Anderson Lopez and Robert Lopez. And if you don't know who those people are, I don't blame you because those are strange names with hyphenation and whatnot. But they're the people who wrote the music for Frozen and Frozen 2 and also, I guess, some Broadway stuff and that song Remember Me from Coco. And they just sat there and played piano and sang these great songs while these four-year-old girls in Elsa costumes got really excited about Let It Go. And it was about the most rad and awesome thing that I've seen in a long time. So I'm very excited about my cultural consumption for once. Suderman, what did you consume?
I saw the movie Richard Jewell, directed by Clint Eastwood, which is just a kind of fascinating cultural experiment in that it is a really sharply made movie, just an incredibly effectively acted, directed, and told true story about a man who was railroaded by the media and even more than that by the FBI, and that it is just absolutely mm-hmm. shot through with a kind of right-of-center, conservative, vaguely libertarian-ish kind of political worldview. And so it's, if nothing else, you know, what I wrote in my piece was that it, if you are, watching it is, as a liberal, I kind of imagine is what it is like to watch a lot of Hollywood movies as a conservative, or at least as a non-liberal, all the time, in that it is both incredibly engaging and really well-made, and also sort of like, irritating, frustrating, right? You're like, oh, the world isn't like that. That's not, oh, this is sort of, right? You're trying to make a defense of Trump. And like, but on the other hand, it's a really well-made movie. And I'll just say it is also probably the only movie about a self-declared libertarian I think maybe I have ever seen. So the lawyer, the guy who ends up being the lawyer for Richard Jewell, in the movie, he never says the word libertarian, but he sits at his office in front of a kind of a bumper sticker type thing on his wall that says, I fear the government more than I fear terrorism. And in the Vanity Fair piece from 1997 that the movie was based on, which is just excellent, and I highly recommend as a story, as a piece of journalism, as a great bit of feature writing, nearly the first thing he says is, and I'm going to slightly paraphrase, but this is close to a quote, is, I am not a Republican because they take your rights. I'm not a Democrat because they take your money. I believe that people have a right to be stupid. I am a libertarian. And he just like, that's the opening, that's the introduction to him, is he's not a Republican, not a Democrat. He wants you to be able to keep your money and your rights. He's a libertarian. You're allowed to make mistakes. And so it's a fascinating movie. It kind of bombed at the box office, but a little bit.
Bombed.
Oh, sorry.
Did it?
Too soon.
Huh.
But yeah, it didn't do super well, but it's a great piece of, it is a fascinating piece of narrative of feature filmmaking.
Nick, what you been doing?
I watched the final episode of the first season of HBO's
What'd you
Watchmen
think? It was great,
last
right?
night, and man, what a great season! And I don't know if and when or how it'll come back, but just an incredible meditation on all sorts of power and possibility in the United States. If you liked the original graphic novel, if you liked the movie or found it interesting, this builds off of that. And last night's episode was, just thinking about it makes me tighten up a little bit, because it talks about love. It talks about the simultaneity of life. And it talks about political power and the current moment in a way that I don't want to give much away, but it's just that entire season is just a remarkable, remarkable achievement. And it reminds us, I think, that when people actually engage the deep meaning of politics and ideology, beautiful, beautiful art and kind of moderation.
Speaking
can
of libertarian
forth,
themes
really
in popular fiction, there's just, without spoiling anything, there's a line in that episode that is said by someone who is maybe not a hero, but is someone we are supposed to agree with this line. And this person says, anyone who seeks to attain the power of a god must be prevented at all costs from obtaining it. And that's like the big idea of the show. It's great.
Yeah. I should also make a pitch, since that's a great libertarian character. Let It Go is a great libertarian song. Totally great libertarian song. The past is just the past. Nick. And also, I should say that on the Frozen 2 soundtrack, if you haven't seen the movie, it's fine. The Weezer does a really good version of the song Lost in the Woods that's worth a listen. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I started a D&D podcast, another one, because that's how I roll. Critical Role
how
is like...
How you roll?
Oh, sorry. Critical Role is good
roll
and
it's
kind of like the... like D&D podcast. It's the big boy in the room. But those episodes are really long and super involved. And there's a lot of people. And I only listen to podcasts in like 8-minute bursts. And so it was a little too much for me. So I switched over to the Adventure Zone. I am only 5 years behind on this podcast. So you're welcome for this cutting edge recommendation, listeners. It's great. It's a family playing D&D. It's the guys from my brother and me. If you start at the very beginning, they explain to you how to play D&D, which is something that is kind of nice to listen to people learn. It's nice to hear people learn new things and then come to really enjoy them and to be part of that fun. And maybe that's a little bit what this podcast is like for our listeners. I hope if you are interested in D&D, The Adventure Zone, not a path-breaking recommendation, but genuinely very good and very fun. And I will just say as an asterisk that the reason that I started listening to this podcast is because, as previously mentioned on the Reason Roundtable, I have totally gotten into the D&D content that TikTok provides, and people use The Adventure Zone podcast to create like lip syncs of weird audio in the personas of the characters from The Adventure Zone. And actually 2019 is good.
I am struggling to imagine a more on brand ending of a podcast than Catherine recommending TikToks of versions of D&D podcasts. Nicely done. Thank you to everyone out there for listening. Please go to our podcast page. That's with an S. Reason.com. Super double backslash. No, just single one. Podcasts to get subscribed to all of them, including the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum debates. And we'll catch you next week. Goodbye.
That was the pink laser noise.